Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Delighted to be in conversation today with Mary Beth Pfeiffer, projects writer and chief investigative reporter for the Poughkeepsie Journal, a daily newspaper in New York's Hudson Valley that the AP named New York State Newspaper of Distinction in its class 3 of the last 4 years, and that won the most awards this year in the 40-year history of the New York News Publishers Association. For the last few months, she's been researching and writing a series of articles about an epidemic of drug addiction that is sweeping the state and the nation. According to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the U.S. is in the midst of a growing deadly epidemic of prescription painkiller abuse. The nation's rate of drug overdose death, the CDC says, has tripled since 1990 and has never been higher. In previous investigations, Mary Beth exposed vast overcharging of the federal government by New York State for care of the developmentally disabled and showed widespread police misuse of stun guns, also called tasers. Most recently, she exposed flaws in the care of people with Lyme disease. The Lyme series, No Small Thing, was read nationwide and has been credited with spurring a reform bill just passed by the New York State Legislature to protect Lyme doctors from professional censure for treating patients outside of government endorsed guidelines. After exposing mistreatment of mentally ill inmates in New York State solitary confinement units, Mary Beth was named as a 2005 Soros Justice Media Fellow and reported on prison abuses nationwide. The research led to an article in the New York Times Magazine, which in turn led to a book, Crazy in America, The Hidden Tragedy of the Criminalized Mentally Ill. She's dismayed that the book is still relevant today and has continued to report on abuses in New York. Mary Beth Pfeiffer has won dozens of New York Publishers Association and State AP Awards and has been honored with 3 National Headliner Awards, a Sigma Delta Chi Award for Investigative Reporting, the AP Managing Editor's Public Service Award, and awards from the Scripps Howard Foundation, Inter-America Press Association, and the Gannett Company, the journal's owner. She's written for the New York Times Magazine, Village Voice, Boston Globe, Miami Herald, Hartford Current, Des Moines Register, and U.S. Weekend Magazine. A graduate of Marist College in Poughkeepsie, New York. She resides in Ulster County, New York, with her husband, our old friend Robert Maraldi, a journalism professor and author of Scoop Artist, a biography of the investigative reporter Seymour Hersh. You can read her articles at www.poughkeepsiejournal.com or follow her on Twitter at MarybethPF or call her at 845-437-4869. Welcome, Mary Beth Pfeiffer. What a delight to have you here. You know, you've always been a hero to all of us, and I just want to know how you got into the game.
By the game, I take it you mean...
Journalism.
Into journalism. Okay. That goes back quite a ways. We're talking the late 1970s.
You're still a very young woman.
Oh, thank you so much. And basically, I had sort of a talent for writing, and I remember in the fourth grade getting up in front of the assembly and reading the... poem of the week to the entire school.
You wrote the poem?
Yes, yes.
Wow.
But I also had this sense, and I told my first editor in my first interview that I wanted to change the world. And in some small way, journalism really does allow you to participate at least in that process of making things better.
Well, we don't see many like you, to be fair. We don't see people who go out and really rake the coals and figure out what could be better. We see a lot of sort of humdrum reporting, but we don't see a lot of digging. What's that all about?
I might agree with that, but on the other hand, it costs a lot of money to have somebody
sure.
like me on staff and to give me the time that's necessary to really dig into a topic. I might spend a month, sometimes 2 months, on a single story.
Hmm.
And it's to the credit of my newspaper that they devote the resources that are necessary.
And we'll get back to that in a moment, but I want to ask more about you personally. I hope you don't mind.
No problem.
I want to know a little bit about, I mean, you have this instinct, but obviously the greatest educators in our lives are our parents. Freud said, you know, 4 years old, character's all over. What did your parents do for you?
My father was an orthotist, meaning that he made braces for people with polio, prosthetic devices. He also ran a surgical supply company.
Mm.
He was a high school graduate. He built a big business up from the ground, worked 6 days a week, very hard worker, very great role model. My mom, similarly, went back to college when I was in high school to become a nurse, studied like crazy, though she had 4 kids to take care of, and it was just a very strong force in our house partly because my dad was working so much, but also because I come from a long line of strong women.
So, Mary Beth Pfeiffer, I thoroughly enjoyed your piece online, but it's so prescient because we had Dr. Richard Horowitz here for an hour, like we are talking to you for an hour, and he complained that, you know, there were all kinds of trouble with the medical authorities who weren't allowing him to do his thing. And his thing basically was that the tick carries more than Lyme. It carries a lot of other things. And he treats everybody for all of it, all the possibilities that there are. And then your series comes out. Were you influenced by him at all?
Well, I certainly interviewed him several times. He was a font of information on Lyme disease, probably unlike almost any other doctor in the nation.
Sure.
He is really the go-to person. And what he is saying about Lyme treatment is very true. Doctors have been hampered in their choices of how to treat Lyme disease because it is so controversial, because so many people seem to have symptoms that persist past the point of being treated with antibiotics, because the Infectious Disease Society of America has basically dictated how doctors will treat, and they say no more, basically, than 3 to 4 weeks of antibiotic treatment. And at that point, the Lyme spirochete is killed off.
It turns out it's much more than the Lyme spirochete.
Well, there are reasons that people have lingering symptoms. And the answers to why they have those lingering symptoms are still not known. But there are studies showing that the Lyme spirochete can persist in animals. They're still trying to ferret out whether it does persist in people. Suffice to say, I have interviewed many people, including doctors themselves, who have had longer courses of antibiotics and have responded well when they've had Lyme disease.
So it's controversial. So you, as a star reporter, you are a star reporter for us on the Poughkeepsie Journal. When you write a piece like this, they're controversial. Do you get it in the neck? People call you up and contest with you?
Well, yes. The Centers for Disease Control officials there were not very happy with my take on this disease. I, in many ways, have run counter to the mainstream press in reporting on Lyme disease. And it took a lot of reading. It took a lot of ferreting out these very complex studies, scientific studies, and consulting with experts to interpret them for me, because I'm not a biologist, I'm not a scientist. But ultimately, after doing that kind of work, after talking to a lot of people, I came to the conclusion that government and the policies that they are endorsing of the Infectious Disease Society may not have all the answers, that there was more here, and that people needed to discuss it more, debate it more, and to have more choices. So the New York State Legislature actually passed a bill in the closing days of the legislature under which doctors will be more free to treat outside of the very firm and hard and fast firm guidelines.
Now, I know you don't like to blow your own horn, but you think that that law should be named the Mary Beth Law?
I think that probably my reporting had something to do with it, but there is also a very large Lyme community out there into which I tapped.
And a lot of legislators who had it and their kids.
And legislators who are also listening to that Lyme community, and as well as having it in their own families. Representative Chris Gibson is in the Hudson Valley. He lives in Kinderhook in Columbia County, and he's a very big proponent of Lyme disease treatment reform. And he's listening to the people out there who are begging and clamoring for it.
Mary Beth Pfeiffer, let's go to your latest pieces and tell us why you chose to talk about the epidemic. Obviously, it is an epidemic. And when I had an operation recently, a back operation, they gave me OxyContin, which I, of course, never used because I'm scared to death of it, and put it in a drawer. And my wife came across it the other day and said, "Well, what's this OxyContin doing here?" I said, "Well, we have to bring it over to the police station, drop it in the receptacle there, because people steal for it, they rob for it, now we're hearing it's so hard to get that it's created an uptick in the use of heroin, which is far easier to get and far cheaper for a sort of a different high." And so how did you get into it, and what have you found?
Well, all those things you just said are true, and anybody with additional or extra supplies of prescription painkillers in their homes that they're not using should dispose of them properly. Take them to a police station or a certified disposal spot. Because yes, they are getting out onto the black market. Kids are stealing them from medicine chests. They are being abused, and they are leading to serious, serious problems.
And what do they do
in society?
In other words, what is somebody who takes this stuff going to feel?
Well, you do get high from them, but the way this really happened goes back to 1996, and that was when OxyContin came onto the market, and it came onto the market with the advisory that it really wasn't a danger for addiction. The FDA actually approved the label on OxyContin to say that addiction as a result of this drug would be, quote-unquote, very rare. It was based on a study of burn victims who were treated in the short term who only showed a 1% addiction rate. Well, that turned out not to be true and not to be reliable. But in the intervening time between the introduction of OxyContin and this terrible epidemic that we're experiencing now, there was a huge marketing campaign for OxyContin.
You mean on public on public facilities like...
No, the pharmaceutical industry sold this very heavily. So much so that OxyContin went from $48 million in sales in 1996 to $1.1 billion by 2001.
Whoa.
Huge, huge increase. And they did this by holding, for example, 40 conferences around the country, all expense paid, for doctors, for pharmacists, in which they schooled them in OxyContin, sold the idea that this was not addictive, and trained them to be speakers to other doctors.
Well, some people saw that as a sort of a bribe, that they would pay them, quote, to give speeches. I know a lot of doctors who give speeches. And really what's being done here, a lot of people think, is getting them to give speeches so they can get some money. They give them money for that, and therefore they then become proselytizers for the drug.
Well, there are studies that show that doctors are not influenced by these sorts of gambits and gigs. Yeah, I would say that we can raise questions as to whether, in fact, they are influenced and unduly influenced. But the other things they did as part of this marketing campaign, it was the first time in the history of pharmaceuticals that a controlled substance was sold in this way. They gave out stuffed animals that said OxyContin. They gave out fishing hats, OxyContin. They gave out CDs that had music on them, swing along with OxyContin. 34,000 coupons were distributed for free 7 to 30 day supplies of OxyContin. Well, needless to say, the drug caught on, and the figures show how successful this marketing campaign was. That also led to other kinds of drugs like this to enter the market and to see very big, you know, significant hikes in their sales. But ultimately, we learned the hard way that it was, in fact, an addictive drug, that despite the claims of the maker that the OxyContin was a special formulation that was time release. So it wasn't prone to abuse because you couldn't take it all at once and get this powerful bang. Well, what happened is people learned that they could crush it. They could make a slurry of it.
What was that word you used, a slurry?
Slurry, yeah. They could basically ingest it and get that instant high. They could even inject it or snort it.
It's just that I never heard the word slurry before.
Yeah, okay. It's a mixture of stuff. Yeah. And so it became very much prone to abuse. The other thing, though, it turned out that when you used it for chronic pain, you became dependent on it. Whether you abused it in that way or not, you became dependent on it. And we're also learning now that using it for chronic pain turns out to be not such an effective way to treat pain. You need more and more of it to have an effect, and it makes the user very tired. It makes the user essentially, new studies are showing, just sort of drop out of life because it's very hard to keep going when you're under the influence of this kind of drug. So there are just so many ways in which OxyContin fell down on the job, as did the marketing of OxyContin, in telling us and telling the public that this was not an addictive drug. It was, in fact, addictive, and it hooked many, many people. And
is it hard to get off once you're on?
It's very difficult. It is on par with heroin. It is in the same family of drugs as heroin.
It is?
It has the same effect on the brain. Yes, it is an opioid. It's ultimately derived from, either synthetically or naturally, the poppy seed. And I'd also add that it's really not a debated point that this drug was oversold. The company that introduced it ultimately had to pay $600 million in fines for fraudulent marketing.
Can you be a little bit more specific about what that fraudulent marketing involved?
For knowingly contending that OxyContin was less addictive and less prone to abuse because of this special formulation that they had for the time release of the product.
Does OxyContin have cousins? In other words, other drugs that are sort of like OxyContin?
Yes, there's Vicodin, and I guess Vicodin is the chief contender for a competition with OxyContin. Right now, oxycodone, which is the generic for OxyContin, and hydrocodone, which is what Vicodin is made out of, are the two leading opioid drugs being used in New York State and around the country. One of these stories that I did was an analysis of the sales of all the controlled substances in New York State. I got the top 10 drugs for each of our 62 counties. Well, lo and behold, the top drugs in 60 of those 62 counties was either oxycodone or hydrocodone.
Wow.
And that was last year. And the volumes of product being put out there on the market was really quite surprising. 6.9 million prescriptions in a single year in New York State for those two drugs. Upstate, the rate at which those two drugs were prescribed would allow each adult to have, or 6 in 10 adults to have, a single prescription. That's a lot of drug out there.
Mary Beth Pfeiffer, do we have any kind of understanding as to how much was really being used to treat pain? How much was being used, you know, for a high?
I think we don't.
Mm-hmm.
We do know that a great deal of it was diverted for non-medical uses. One of the statistics I came across recently is that 12 million people admitted in 2010 in a national survey to non-medical use of opioids, namely, I got it from my friend, I wasn't prescribed it, I used it off prescription. So that's a lot of people.
Well, then talk to us about the doctors who were doing the prescribing.
Well, doctors would claim that they were responding to a need out there. And they're right, to an extent. When you go back to the 1970s, we had this sense in the medical community that we couldn't give morphine or related painkillers even to people in end-stage cancer because they might become addicted. There was a great fear of addiction.
For morphine.
For morphine and related.
Could you just stop for a second,
sure.
Little parenthesis here. What's the relationship between OxyContin and morphine?
Morphine is also an opioid. All these drugs are in the same class of drug. They come ultimately from the poppy seed. And back in the 70s, we had morphine. We had methadone back then, which is also used as a painkiller. I'm trying to think of the others. But we had painkillers in that family of drugs, but we did not avail ourselves of them because there was this great fear of addiction.
You didn't get morphine pills to take home from you after your back operation?
No, not back then. Well, we have completely gone from one end of the spectrum to the other because there became this awareness in the 80s and 90s that we had to start treating pain a little bit more efficiently. We weren't doing a good job. And people were right. There was a great clamor to treat pain. And in many ways, the OxyContin manufacturers of the world seized that. And they came along at the right time, and that was when we were slowly becoming aware that we were undertreating pain. Even the Joint Commission on Accreditation of Hospitals came out around the year 2000 with a scale of pain, We will ask patients what you're feeling on a scale of 1 to 10, and many hospitals were required to ask that so we could gauge your pain and treat your pain. So doctors sort of stepped into this situation in which these prescriptions products were coming along, the awareness was growing, the Joint Commission was saying, ask about pain.
And they were being lectured to by the drug companies about the advantages of OxyContin and Condo.
Exactly. And these painkillers work, too. When you have short-term pain, they are very effective. I broke my shoulder in February while I was skiing in Vermont. I was taken to an emergency room in Bennington, was treated. I was given OxyContin. I took it. I was only given several pills to take home with me.
Was this before you started work on this?
This was before I started work on this series, but I did know I was going to do this series. So it was an interesting confluence of events. I found the OxyContin helped me a lot. I was in a great deal of pain. And doctors tell me that this is the way this drug should be used for acute short-term pain or perhaps end-of-life pain. But the chronic pain is the question. They're not so sure anymore, or science is not so sure. Researchers aren't.
Define chronic for us.
Chronic would be something that's ongoing and years long. I have had calls from people with rheumatoid arthritis who tell me they need this drug. I am hampering their ability to get this drug, although this is certainly much bigger than me and started, you know, well before I came on the scene. So chronic, yes, is some long-term condition, maybe some sort of back injury that you sustained at work. But what I'm hearing is that the person who had that back injury and gets onto one of these opioids for the long term is much less likely to go back to work as a result.
What about the police agencies in terms of, you know, the illicit or illegal use of this stuff? What have the police agencies been involved? Are they scared because they're doctors who have prescribed this stuff, or would they rather stay out of it, or are they getting involved?
Well, they're certainly getting involved because they're seeing prescription drugs turn up on the street. They also are getting involved big time because it is leading to this wave of heroin abuse. But I was talking to a long-term 20-year detective last week, and he said to me that this is the most devastating thing he's ever seen, because he responds to these overdose calls and these overdose deaths, and he sees where they're occurring and who is affected and the magnitude of the problem. It's huge. It is a huge public health problem. It is a huge crisis.
Now, the antidote to heroin is now being prescribed for police and other first responders to carry around with them. Is there such a thing for opioids?
There is. It's called Narcan, or naloxone is the generic form. And every first responder, meaning police agencies, ambulance attendants, emergency medical technicians, will be eventually armed with this tool. It's very effective. It's used intranasally, namely up the nose, sometimes intravenously. And I had a doctor recount when he used it in an emergency room. And he said a young man was brought in. Somebody just left him and took off. And he said this young man was on his last breath. And he gave him Narcan, not knowing that that was the problem.
Is that the same stuff used for heroin?
Yes. And he immediately revived.
We're talking with Mary Beth Pfeiffer, projects writer and chief investigative reporter for the Poughkeepsie Journal. Okay, so Mary Beth, let's talk a little bit more about what has happened to this drug. Now, we keep hearing that heroin is now becoming a drug of choice because it's cheaper and because it's getting too hard to get the OxyContin and its cousins. So is that true?
It is getting much more difficult to
How
get
come?
Prescription painkillers. Well, 16 states now, including New York, have passed prescription monitoring programs, namely laws in which doctors have to check the prescribing history of the patient that they're seeing. So in New York...
How do they know that somebody isn't lying to them? In other words...
Well, that's what was happening for years before this law went into effect.
Right.
You would go to your GP and you'd go to your orthopedist and you'd go to your, you know, ear, nose and throat person. And you'd say, I've got pain here, there and everywhere. And a lot of people did that. They did it for two reasons, because they were abusers or they did it to make money. But now that's much more difficult to do in New York and these other states. And that's because the doctor looks on this database, sees if you've been to here or there for prescription drugs, and says, yes or no, I'm going to give you this prescription or I'm not. And as a result, the prescribing figures have really dropped. In New York, in the last quarter of last year, hydrocodone prescriptions went down by 20%. And hydrocodone was tops in 47 of 62 counties last year.
It's so interesting because we don't allow the prescription of heroin. We do OxyContin. But we're able to cut back on the prescriptions by tightening up, which is something we can't do with heroin. Have you thought about that?
Well, I've thought about that in terms of we have an epidemic right now that was created through legal means, by legal drugs. I saw a tweet by a doctor who's very upset about this and has formed a group of physicians for responsible opioid prescribing. And the tweet featured a photograph of a billboard and a doctor saying, come to me for your pain. And his tweet was to the effect that now, today, drug dealers come in white lab coats.
I hear you. But let's try the other side of that one, the heroin. Have we learned anything, Mary Beth Pfeiffer, from the opioid controls that we've put in place that might be applied to the heroin side of things, which is not, I mean, you can't get heroin from a doctor.
Heroin is much more difficult to control out there. I mean, there is an illicit trade in heroin. It's very lucrative. Sure. It comes from the Middle East, by and large.
Black market.
And it's just a real serious problem in terms of the drug issue. What I would say on that, though, Alan, is we have for far too long treated drug addiction and drug problems as a criminal justice issue and not as a public health issue. And that's the direction we need to go with this.
So could you fill that out for us a little bit? I mean, I'm so old that I was actually around when all kinds of ways of methadone, for example, I wrote the first government report, I believe, back in the day, when Fred Orenstein and his group on the Mental Health Committee decided that that was the way to go. But it never turned out that we really knew how to do it, how to offer alternatives. And I know that both Rockefeller and Lindsay thought that by being more humane, we could create a better system. And then when that broke down, came the Rockefeller drug laws. I mean, that's how we got them. So I'm wondering.
I would say that we never followed through on the promise of that idea, that grain of an idea that you just referred to way back when. Instead, we built, 40 new prisons in New York State from the early 80s through the year 2000.
Some would argue with you that the reason we built the prisons is because judges were saying, okay, go for rehab or go to jail, and people go to rehab and they jump out the window and continue on their merry way when the Rockies and the others decided that this other thing wasn't, he didn't have much patience for a plan that wasn't really working, and he went to the other side.
I'd say that we went too far to the other side. There's certainly a balance to be struck between some people who deal in drugs, who belong in prison, and many others who possess and use who don't. Mm-hmm. We spend upwards of, it's probably $35,000 per person per year in our state prisons, and 80% of the prison population is there for drug crimes. Mm-hmm. And we're still doing the same old thing. We need to do things differently. We need to provide a lot more treatment. We need to devote money to prevention programs. That $35,000 per person multiplied by what we have about 55,000 inmates, could go a very, very long way.
Is there resistance to this? I mean, we have a prison industry in New York State, and every time we talk about closing down a prison or something, you get economic development arguments coming at you. What have you found?
Prisons provide jobs. There's no doubt about that. But let's make jobs in a different way. Let's open halfway houses for people who need drug treatment. Let's do more prevention programs. I was speaking to the director of the main prevention program in my area recently. She told me that her budget had been cut from 2008, when it was $1.1 million, to $675,000 this year. Now, we are in the midst of a huge epidemic, and she gets a 30-plus percent cut in her funding.
Do we know how to bring people back?
From addiction?
Yes.
It's a real tough nut to crack.
Sure.
There's no doubt about it. It often takes time and time again, and 3 or 4 tries at detoxification and rehabilitation before it sticks.
How do we do it?
We put people in a hospital. We basically allow them time to heal, time to get the drugs out of their system, to be counseled. We offer them the opportunity. And what I've been hearing for the last several months while I've been working on this is, I tried to get my son into detox 6 times in the last 7 years. He got 3 days of detox. The insurance company kept saying no. Or the insurance company said, you can have 1 day and then you have to leave. And that's been a recurring problem, that people can't get into detox for a long enough period of time. And I'm talking like 28 days minimum is what I'm told you need if you're addicted to heroin or opioid painkillers.
Is there anything on the horizon which would allow us to be more successful in cure?
I did read recently of a vaccine that's been tested on animals that basically makes them immune to overdose by opioids and immune to getting high from them. That's an interesting concept. As far as treatment, it's really still very much an evolving art. They call it evidence-based. You know, they see what works and they try it. But I think suffice to say that we just need to keep trying. We have to recognize that this is a disease, and it's a chronic disease. It's not a disease that ever goes away or is cured. It's always going to need some form of maintenance.
It's like when somebody stands up at an AA meeting and says, I'm an alcoholic.
Exactly. And we stand to save a lot of money by treating it. There was a hospital study done that compared people with substance abuse issues to people who didn't have them, who came to the hospital. And whether you came for addiction or not, or for something else, it cost the hospital $10,000 more on average to treat that person with the substance abuse problem. They cost society a great deal of money, and we will save money ultimately if we go there and put the dollars where they belong.
Do we have any, Mary Beth Pfeiffer, do we have any idea about what the criminal implications of all of this are? In other words, we know in heroin, for example, people steal in order to get the drug. Has that happened in the oxycodones?
There have been certainly burglaries related to prescription painkillers. There was an awful set of murders at a pharmacy on Long Island related to a holdup for prescription drugs. So there certainly is related crime. I don't think you see the drive-by shootings in the certain neighborhoods that you saw with crack cocaine or even with the heroin epidemic. And that brings me to kind of the nature of this epidemic. It really affects suburban people to a much greater extent. It affects whites to a greater extent. The numbers have really changed in a rather short period of time. From 2004 to 2011, we went from upstate people being 36% of drug overdose deaths to 60% of drug overdose deaths. And when I say upstate, I mean outside of New York City. So there are much, the non-city residents are really now overrepresented as far as overdose deaths. Whites, we went from 47% of deaths in 2004 being among white people. Now it's 71% of deaths. And the sheer numbers have really gone up. We've seen the numbers go up from about 900 to about 2,000 per year.
So who does the distribution of the stuff, the illegal distribution?
Of prescription painkillers?
Yes.
You know, I asked a police officer that, and he said, bring me some drug dealers, and I'll tell you. In other words, we're still trying to figure all this out. It's out there. It's on the market. Kids are taking it from medicine chests. One case that I wrote about recently, a kid started in high school with some drugs that were taken out of the home of another friend, and he experimented with them. He became hooked, and he eventually ended up dying from a heroin overdose.
In your reportage, have you spoken with addicts themselves?
Yes. And there's one in particular who has started an organization in my area to basically raise awareness about this and to try and remove the stigma of drug addiction. It's a silent, stigmatized killer. People don't want to talk about it. A story I wrote recently was based on a list of 63 people who had died of accidental drug overdoses in Dutchess County. And we tried very hard to reach the families, to get them to speak with us. I was able to write a story based on many of their obituaries that ran. It really told a story of who they were. And they were regular folks, you know. They were the guy down the street and the lady on the supermarket line and the Yankee fan, and the obituaries were just so touching. But ultimately, we were able to get just 7 families to speak with us, and we wrote stories of those 7 people. Others just feel so ashamed and you know, just silent in their grief. And that's what we need to change. There's always going to be that grief, obviously, but people need to know that this is a disease and it's not something to be ashamed of.
Well, you know, we've always said that about mental health, for example, always. Yeah, you know, the stigma is so great. I wrote my doctoral dissertation in the area, and yet it doesn't change. You know, we say it should change, we've got to make it change, but it doesn't change.
Change is a very, very slow process, and I think I'd probably say that there is less of a stigma overall
but
about
only because
mental illness. And as you know,
yeah,
I wrote a book about mental illness.
Do. Yes.
I think people are more willing to admit I'm taking an antidepressant today, for example.
Sure, oh yeah.
I'm not, but I mean,
no,
what I mean
you.
Is
sure.
that they're willing to say that. So it is a little bit more out in the open, but I agree with you totally. It just takes a very long time, and the change is very subtle, and there still is that ongoing stigma.
Let me read you an AP story. One day before lawmakers broke for the summer, Governor Andrew Cuomo and other state lawmakers announced an agreement to combat the heroin and opioid epidemic sweeping New York. It will also target prescription drug abuse. The package deal has 8 bills. Legislation would require every anti-overdose kit for heroin to have information about how to help stop an overdose and the dangers of the drug. The bills will create a statewide public awareness campaign about the dangers of opioids, increase penalties on illegal drug use and distribution, and require insurance companies to better cover substance abuse treatment. The last, of course, Mary Beth Pfeiffer, is precisely what you were talking about, the ability to get the insurance companies to pay for some of this stuff. Obviously, if both houses of the legislature and the governor get together and in a last push before the last rose of summer, they come up with this thing, they are aware that this is a terrible issue.
There is a huge awareness now. All those things that happened in the waning days of our legislative session were terrific. We needed that coverage by the insurance companies. We needed to deliver that message to the insurance companies that you have to provide inpatient care and you can't so easily reject people for it. It remains to be seen how well it will work. It will be a very big process.
Well, it will all get transferred to the bottom line. Obviously, the people who pay for the insurance will pay more.
Right. But will the insurance companies actually follow through and provide the necessary care? It's going to be hugely expensive.
Don't get me started on that one, but because I don't think the insurance companies ought to be in the whole thing. I think we ought to be a direct payer for our health care, but that's not the way it is, and so we have to deal with what we got.
And unfortunately, we can't even have that discussion in America today.
Mm-hmm, that's correct.
Yeah. But the naloxone, that's a very good development. That'll save lives already. I think 25,000 doses of it have been distributed to counteract the effects of an overdose. We had a public training in Narcan, naloxone, recently. 150 parents, family members showed up to get this treatment, and they each went home with a dose of naloxone. It was the biggest training session so far in New York State. Incredible potential there to save people's lives.
Well, I think it's wonderful that the Poughkeepsie Journal, it's a Gannett paper, supports your work on this because, as you mentioned before, it's expensive. You know, you may work all year on a subject, but it's so untypical of our press today. You're a shining light, Mary Beth, in the way that it should be done. But it is not the way the press is going. Do you have any comment on that? You're married to a journalism professor. Have you talked about this?
Oh, we talk about it constantly, about the future of the press and the current state of the press. And there isn't enough solid reporting and solid journalism going on
today. And it's going the wrong way.
It is, because journalism and the media and newspapers are in such flux right now. The internet has, on the one hand, been a wonderful, wonderful resource for me as a reporter, both to enable my research and to get out my message. But on the other hand, it has created incredible challenges for newspapers like mine and many others, because there are just so many outlets out there for news these days, and people expect that they should get news for free.
And some good ones and some terrible ones. So let me ask you, when you worked on mental health, after the articles came a book. Will a book come from this?
Well, that remains to be seen, I guess. I do follow things for a very long period of time. And what happened with my book called Crazy in America, I had been covering New York State prisons for quite some time. And I found that there were many suicides occurring in the solitary confinement units. Long and short, one thing led to another, and the people who were committing suicide there were generally people with serious mental illness who were unmanageable in the prison population, and they were put into solitary confinement because that's all they could do with them. They didn't know how to handle them. And I covered that issue for a very long period of time from a number of different perspectives, told the tragic stories of people who had died, ultimately wrote a book about that.
But, just by this education you've given yourself and us this hour, but you, I mean, you can cite statistics. You've done all of this work. It would be a shame not to have a permanent place to put all this information, a book, because we don't see it.
Journalism does live on the internet. On our website, you can look up any one of my Lyme disease stories.
Yeah.
They get a lot of traffic.
Not the same thing.
All right, I'll consider that, Alan.
I was talking to Garrison Keillor just the other day. He was here for something, and he said, "So," because he's written a lot of books. He said, "Have you written anything?" I said, "Yes, I wrote two books." He said, "Really? What were they?" I said, "Well, one was called Me and Mario. It was my adventures with the governor, and the other came much earlier. It's called Strengthening the Wisconsin Legislature." Well, he got a smile from one ear to the other, you know. The absurdity of strengthening the Wisconsin legislature. But you know what? I've done a lot of work in my life, but books have a certain permanence.
They do, and I am very proud of my book, and I'm so glad it lives on out there.
Yeah, sure.
But the other thing I have to tell you is...
Did you get any garbage for using the word crazy in the title?
I got a little bit.
Yeah.
A little bit. And I thought long and hard about that, but yeah. I was saying that America was crazy.
Every time I use it, I get it.
Yeah. Right. But the other thing about writing books is there's not very much money to be made in writing books unless you hit the bestseller list. So I spent a very long time writing the book. Luckily, I had a fellowship to support me.
Yeah.
And I do get modest royalty checks, but paychecks are kind of nice to have, too.
Books are about money. I don't think so. I think.
Well, you have to pay the electric bill.
No,
Alan.
You do. Yeah, but I think books are more about, you know, a permanent stamp on our public consciousness and, you know, our contribution to it. So tell me about your relationship with your editor. I'm not implying anything untoward here, but we love your editor, Stu Shinsky, and we think he's the best in the business. And it must be something to be able to have somebody who understands.
I'm smiling because I have a terrific editor. I am very blessed as a journalist to have someone I can work with who appreciates what I do, understands what I do, and can critique what I do. Because the best of journalists need somebody looking over their shoulder to tell them, that's the wrong word, or you didn't quite get that thought across. And, you know, the other way in which I'm very blessed with Stu is that he gives me the time that's necessary. He doesn't say, what are you doing today? Where is this story going? He knows that stories unfold and the onion needs to be peeled back slowly and the path needs to be followed and all those other sort of metaphors. But investigative reporting is a labor-intensive job and it just takes the time. And luckily, I am given that time.
Have you ever had an editor, unlike Stu Shinsky, who didn't understand?
Well, I've had other editors who weren't as easy to work with, but I think that I also have grown into this position because I've been around for quite a while. And there was a time where I did enterprise reporting or long-term reporting. I had trouble saying I was an investigative reporter, but I've gotten there. I've gotten over that. And part of it was just a learning on the job and, you know, mastering the tools of this trade.
Yeah. Do you ever get tired of being a reporter?
Well, I get tired sometimes of the weight I have to carry, the stressing over every detail. If you take this job seriously, you really
check and recheck,
and it just kills you if you see something that's wrong in a story. And I'm talking about Saturday night, I saw there was an extra semicolon next to a comma. And that upset me.
Yeah, but
it's those bigger things that you really worry about. And so there's always a stressful job, but ultimately it's exceedingly rewarding.
You see the young people coming up now in journalism. What's your advice?
My advice for the young people, oh, that's tough because, you know, journalism, as I said, is going in so many different directions. I think they need to learn things like working with databases and programs like Access and Excel.
But of course, none of that was there when you started coming up.
No, and I learned on the job. I was sent away to the University of Missouri for training.
They sent you away? Yeah.
And that was in the 1990s, and it was probably the best investment the Poughkeepsie Journal ever made.
Yeah. Unless, of course, you said, well, so long, Poughkeepsie Journal, I'm going somewhere else now that you've trained me. We've seen that.
People do that. But then you hope that you'll get somebody coming to your door who does have those tools, who has worked with those programs. But, you know, also I think you have to read good journalism if you're going to be a journalist. You should read the New York Times, the New Yorker.
Do you see any change in the way I read the Times 4 or 5 times a day, and I read it online. And I think I detect a difference in the way they're writing these days. They're trying to be a little bit more accessible than in the old days.
I definitely sense that as well. And I like it. And I think we all need to do it. You know, even to use the word I, to talk about yourself in some occasions, to have a voice, to kind of tell people what you're telling them, not be so tied to these very narrow ways of expressing ourselves through quoting other people. Or I wrote a story about 63 people, as I said, who died from heroin or prescription pain overdoses. And it's written in a much different style than anything I might have written a few years ago. It has a voice that says, this is very sad. This shouldn't be happening. There's a tone of indignation. And we've always had those very hard and fast lines in journalism, sometimes appropriately, that we have to keep ourselves out of the story. Well, in this case, I think it was appropriate to put myself in some way in that story to say, this is not acceptable. This is very sad what's happening in our community.
Mary Beth Pfeiffer, tell us about your relationship with the editorial side of the paper. Now, you've written this terrific series here now on the opioids and on addiction. Obviously, the paper will editorialize on this. Do they come to you and ask you to fill them in?
No, they don't. We have a fairly
strict
solid
separation.
Wall between us. Our editorial page editor, John Penny, who writes most of the editorials, will read my stories.
Sure.
May occasionally ask for a source or a report, but he writes the editorials. He does the research. He wants to understand the issue before he writes about it. And I admire him for that and welcome his support because he is also saying a lot of the things that I think I'm pointing to as problems in this issue. We need to do more on this heroin and painkiller epidemic.
10 years from now, are we going to see newspapers with print on them?
Well, that's another very good question. And I think less and less we certainly will see the printed paper. What I worry about more is that there are fewer and fewer readers because they have so many other outlets and they're interested in entertainment and they're interested in playing games on their iPads and they have a lot more things competing for their time. I want people to want news and that worries me that not enough do.
Yeah. I had the occasion the other day to sit down. As I say, I read the Times online 4 or 5 times a day. I get up in the middle of the night. I read it because what I'm going to do on the air in the studio the next day. But I wonder, when I sit down with the actual physical newspaper, maybe it's because I'm old, but I have a very different impression, just viscerally, of what I'm reading compared to the fleeting moments I'm reading the paper online.
I agree totally. I like the feel of the paper. I like the organization of the paper. I find things in the actual paper that I don't trip over online, because I read it both on my iPad and in the, you know, the physical paper. We get the New York Times delivered. But you're talking from your experience. I'm talking from mine, which is rather dated.
It is.
And kids today are not discovering newspapers in that way. Or we try not to call ourselves a newspaper anymore.
Sure. Is the population getting stupider?
I don't know if I could say that. Certainly wouldn't be politically correct.
Well, no, it's not politically correct, but if people aren't reading the way that they used to, and we know young people really aren't all that interested until, I've always believed, till they get a mortgage, you know, that you can't have a democracy, I've said it a million times, unless you have knowledge.
I think they are less informed, and we need people to seek out information on the issues. If we do want to have informed voters, we need them to vote. Also, and I think news actually creates an impetus for people to act in a democratic society, to go out and vote, to organize, to participate.
Mary Beth Pfeiffer, truly, we are so grateful for your coming up here and spending all of this time with us. You are a remarkable woman, and we've always known it. We've been talking to Mary Beth Pfeiffer, project writer and chief investigative reporter for the Poughkeepsie Journal. Mary Beth, again, what a great hour. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Alan.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, president and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.